you know, as we say in Ignatian circles, go where we're needed, respond to a call, and be available for mission.
This is On a Mission, episode 24. Kate Carter has lived a life dedicated to social justice. She became a Jesuit volunteer in 1978, serving in Montana. She went on to work for JVC and became deeply involved in Central America solidarity work. She was a key member of a group that was bringing news of the oppression of the poor in Central America to faith communities in the U.S. during the tumultuous 1980s and 90s. We talked about what she's learned from observing democratic elections in Central America, how those learnings apply here in the U.S., Catholic connections across borders, her experience of JVC, and where she discovered her passion for hospitality and community. Listen in. Welcome to On a Mission, Kate Carter.
Thanks, Marlene.
It's so great to have you here. I'm super excited to talk to you about what we're going to talk about today.
Thanks. Okay.
Let's start with JVC, Jesuit Volunteer Corps.
I ended up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation in Southeast Montana, working with kids. We had a child care facility, kind of group home, boarding school, school, mission church. And I said yes to JVC, not really knowing what I was getting myself into, but in the process of applying, this is, you know, my dad and mom, I'll say, you know, I'm the oldest of eight kids. My parents raised two other sets of cousins that came to live with us because of family illness and alcoholism in their families. So the idea of living with an eye toward responsibility for someone else really was something that my mom and dad modeled, right? Gospel values of community. And so eventually I would introduce myself to JVs as having come by the community tenet of JVC, honestly.
Yeah.
I'm the oldest of eight kids. I grew up where my parents grew up. Both sets of grandparents were our neighbors. Cousins were my classmates. I grew up within a half a mile of 55 of my 103 first cousins. So the community tribal thing, you know, we knew each other. So I'm applying to be a JV. My dad says, you know, I'm in my second year out of college. My dad says, what do you think you know about social justice? What do you mean social justice, community? What do you think you know? Well, Dad, I'm a woman, for one thing. I think I've experienced some injustices in my life because I'm a woman. My dad, you know, rolls his eyes like, I'm the oldest of eight and there's seven of us girls. So anyway, I challenged him. I remember thinking, Dad, this might not be the choice you would make for me, but given how I was raised and where I was raised, the way you and Mom and Dad have lived, you know, this whole being mindful of others and all kinds of things that they did related to the parish and the neighborhood, right? So this might not be your choice for me, but I don't think it's contrary to how I was raised. And so, yeah, this is my next thing. I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
God bless my dad, because years later I would tell him I was going off to Nicaragua and El Salvador. And he was like, okay, can't you raise the money for that and give it to someone else?
Yep.
Can't someone else do that?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
So maybe a year coincided with the overthrow of the Somoza government in Nicaragua. So when that was happening in July of 79, I was finishing my JV year, and I was already signed on to be on staff in the Midwest. So
For JVC.
For JVC. Yeah. I was going to be on the JVC staff, which at the time was in Cleveland, Ohio. I was also discerning religious life at the time, but I had this job, moved to Cleveland. I stayed on the JVC staff for 3-4 years and left the first time. More to that story. And as my first year on staff was happening, the local support for this revolution in Nicaragua was happening. So I got connected to Central America Solidarity Committees that would eventually lead to learning more and more about that. But interestingly, during my JV year, living in Montana on the reservation, our mission church was also a landing place for Detroit Capuchin staffed parish and mission. And their friary was a kind of a home base for other Capuchins who lived in different mission sites in Southeast Montana. But also during that fall, so I'm in JV 78, 79. So in the fall of 78, two Capuchin friars had to leave Nicaragua because of their work with the poor there. And they came to Montana as a respite place. And we heard about what was happening in Nicaragua. And honestly, I didn't know where Nicaragua was, 2 years out of college.
Sure.
So listening to these guys talk about their work and why they had to leave. And then for that full circle, the Somoza government gets overthrown by revolutionaries. And so then all the solidarity movement started happening, and the Detroit province of the Capuchins, the Jesuits, some of the religious women were forming a solidarity committee in Detroit. I was in Cleveland, but during my first year on staff, I started to work more closely with a Jesuit who would eventually become my colleague. And he was in Detroit, I was in Cleveland. We moved the office from Cleveland to Detroit after my first year. So then I was headed back to the home base, Detroit, for me. With JVC, where I was, remained on staff for a few years. So the connection between JVC and Central America was pretty organic during my JV year, and then working with this Jesuit who was also part-time JVC, part-time this Central America Solidarity Committee. So yeah. Those were certainly doing JVC was a life-changing decision for me and put me on a track away from a master's in student personnel. But then a very life-giving job in terms of discerning this lay leadership, what we considered lay leadership at the time, forming young adults in creating community, living out of the Ignatian spirituality, and doing work with and for the poor. Go ahead.
What did being a part of JVC teach you about poverty in the United States?
Thank you. Living on the reservation, I'd never seen such poverty in my life. And I grew quite angry that this 100-year-old mission church was in the middle of this place where people lived in extreme poverty. Healthcare was minimal, if at all. Violence, alcoholism. And now we're learning through this, Jesuit reparations work about boarding schools being established at the time. And I don't know that this was true where I was, but that boarding schools were on some level a necessity, but also became a way of like deculturizing students, you know, taking away or minimizing their language and culture and creating this. And I wasn't aware of that now, but I, because of my continued connection to what's happening here with the Jesuit provinces in this country, that they're doing some work to address that issue.
I've seen that stuff, some advertisement for those things. Tell us more about that. What is going on right now with, like, that you know of with Jesuits and making reparations for parts that they may have played in all of that boarding schools and re-acculturation and all that?
Well, a couple of things. One, the Jesuit provincials in the US and Canada are addressing their ownership of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And that started a number of years ago at Georgetown University. So that's a whole project. And now the community at Red Cloud Indian School, which I believe is in South Dakota, has asked the Jesuits to address their history of this boarding school being established to create or to move people, you know, education, but also I don't know the word.
It's like a colonization of their education, huh?
Exactly. Exactly. So I just heard about that work in the last week, and I would have to.
I'll link to it in the show notes. I feel like I saw something from Ignatian Solidarity Network.
Yes. The Office of Justice and Ecology in DC, the Jesuit Conference, has announced some work. And I know that the Jesuits provincials are also getting ready to release a statement on the enslaved or their ownership of slaves coming out of that DC effort.
Oh, wow. Okay. So
that's coming too.
Okay. Great. I'll look for what I can find and link to that in our show notes for this episode.
Yeah. So the poverty was something I couldn't have imagined. It was quite devastating. And also learning history that I didn't know as a 24, 25 year old about the creation of reservations, pitting we were on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. We had JVC colleagues on the Crow Reservation, but the Northern Cheyenne and the Crow tribes were enemies of each other. And so the US government, in their wisdom, put their reservations adjacent to each other, hoping they'd kill each other off. I mean, it's just like learning that stuff was just, ugh. So the poverty, the violence, were overwhelming. And I knew that I needed to stay close to people who were going to help me unpack what I saw, what I observed, what we, you know, the kids we were working with who were orphaned because of violence or alcoholism. And, you know, what that was doing decade after decade to, you know, trying to encourage kids to go to college when they just didn't see futures for themselves. But I remember going on a college visit from Ashland, Montana to Cheyenne, Wyoming with one of our high school age students. And she couldn't imagine leaving where she was to go somewhere else and be on that campus. I mean, it was just a really hard concept for her to, how is this going to go? First of all, she was living with us, living in this group home situation where I was a surrogate parent.
Wow.
You know, white lady.
Yeah.
16-year-old girl without parents, family, blood, parents, family. Anyway, that was intense. And yeah, I don't know anything about what happened to Monica, but yeah. So the decision for me to pursue a job with JVC for me was an opportunity to stay close to people who were going to help me learn about why do reservations exist like they exist? Why don't people have what they need in terms of healthcare, food, shelter, education? That was foreign to me. And so the exposure to justice issues, I think growing up, I was aware of service and charity, but JVC introduced me to justice issues and many of them, right? Yeah. So that staying close to people who would help me figure that out,
yeah,
was the motivation to get a job with JVC and stay with it. And then JVC and the Central America connection at the time and in the place. And then when I was finishing JVC the first time, I went to Nicaragua for the first time with a delegation that eventually created something called Witness for Peace that brought delegations to Nicaragua to be at the border.
Wait. You were on the front edge of the creation of Witness for Peace.
I was in the delegation. Yep.
Okay. Well, we'll link to Witness for Peace in the show notes. I just am stunned about that because to me, Witness for Peace has just been around forever. Anyway, so okay, you are going to Central America and your relationship with communities in Central America is growing, it sounds like, organically, and also just, it started organically and it's blooming and blossoming through the early 1980s. Tell us about what you saw and experienced on these several delegations and trips and eventually living there.
Yeah. So the first trip was really this observation of being in Nicaragua and confronting the Contra, who were former Somoza military, who were being supported financially by the US government.
Mm-hmm.
And but we learned that when North Americans were present in these communities at the border, the communities were less vulnerable to Contra attacks. And that was, so this original delegation was called Action for Peace. And while we were there, we met with each other and people from the community to figure out establishing a long-term presence to be witness to what was happening and in some way to be with them in solidarity and therefore offer support, cover. And so Witness for Peace then became this organization that brought delegations from all over the country to be in the country for short periods of time.
Mm.
So being a part of that first delegation, it was really a national delegation of faith-based people who were connected to different faith organizations, parishes.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some kind of big name, but the majority of people were, you know, people like me, you know, people connected to a solidarity committee with an interest in being a part of something bigger. But Henry Nouwen was with us. William Sloan Coffin was with us.
Kate.
Yeah. It's cuckoo. So it was out of that delegation that this idea of Witness for Peace came. And then the next year, we were taking delegations. So Michigan created a Witness for Peace state coordination. We supported a member of the long-term team. Julie Butel was a member of the long-term team for a year. and we supported her while she went off to be on the long-term team, and then short-term delegations went. So I was part of 83, 84, 87, and 90, I believe I went four times. And so hearing about, now by 87 and 90, there was a regime, there was a government change there, because in 90 I was observing elections in Nicaragua. But the idea was persons of faith bringing back, you know, having, being on these observation delegations to bring back stories of what was happening, who, how people were being affected by the militarization of the borders, how the US was involved in that, and bringing back, you know, real life experiences to be told to faith communities in the US.
Right. And what did you discover about how people were being treated and the role of the United States in what was going on in Central America? Because there will be listeners who weren't alive then or who weren't paying attention then.
Yeah. Well, the largest thing was that, of course, the Somoza government, which was the government that was overthrown by the leftist revolutionaries, was in large part supported to be in power by U.S. funds. And there's a famous quote by, I don't know if it was, it must have been the Secretary of State at the time, who might have been, I can't remember who it was, but Somoza may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was responsible. His government was supported by the military, and they were, there was just complete repression of the people, except for the wealthy elite, which is, you know, this is a repeat story in El Salvador, Guatemala, I mean, pick a country. But the wealthy elite were being protected by the military, and everybody else was being oppressed, you know, forced to work in export crops that they didn't benefit from. And the US was supporting that because we were benefiting from the economy, right? The fruit, the rice, the beans, the, you know, whatever's coming out of there that we were benefiting from. And also the idea that once the Somoza government was overthrown, the idea that a leftist revolution could happen in other countries. So, you know, the fear of communism in this country was a way to, for us, for the US government to keep trying to keep tabs on what was happening economically, militarily, in a country that was in our backyard, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that if they're gonna overthrow the government in that country and then another one, you know, because now this is happening, right? People in communities are learning through faith-based organizing, the Christian-based communities, they're studying and interpreting the gospel in the light of their own oppression and misery, and knowing that this is not of God. How we're living is not of God. And so organizing to become a force for change, and then getting labeled, you know, communist, you know, that fear of, which was real here. I mean, yikes. So witnessing people participating in their own organizing, their own, you know, they're establishing their own community vigils. You know, they're on the lookout for danger of the Contra coming into the countryside. And of course this is happening, you know, along, you know, mountainous borders and you know, rural communities. So people have to organize.
Yeah.
For survival. That was one of the remarkable things for me, was that the ability, the idea of community. So coming back to community, as what does it mean to be community, and organizing to help each other, organizing for literacy, organizing for these civil patrols, and people taking turns doing that.
Yeah.
Those were stories that we came back with, right? Yeah. And knowing that, because our government was so involved economically and militarily, that a North American presence in those communities was a safety net for the people who lived there. So having a long-term presence there and bringing people on a regular basis to tell the truth about what was happening, we were doing a lot of work stateside when we got back with congressional reps to cut off military aid to the sources of oppression and repression and
right, because these communities are living in the mountains, rural areas, and they are petrified of the very real possibility that the military is going to come in and murder them all, because the military sees them as a threat to the structure of government that they have been trained to uphold.
Yeah. And now they're former military, right? In Nicaragua, that now they're former military, but they've formed what they call contra armies.
Mm-hmm.
Because inside the country, the new government, the popular government, is promoting literacy campaigns and healthcare, you know, and they're getting support from other solidarity groups, right?
So these are rogue militias that are former from the old regime.
Yeah. But meanwhile, literacy campaigns, because people have been illiterate, healthcare campaigns, the establishment of, you know, community councils that are going to help people with literacy, and eventually leading toward free and fair elections. Because of course, elections haven't been free and fair in a repressive military situation. So yeah, the new government is of the people, for the people, by the people.
Mm-hmm.
Watching literacy and healthcare become real in rural communities where it didn't exist was part of what you saw over time, right? So that by the time they've overthrown a repressive government, but they're working toward free and fair elections that will eventually elect a Congress and a president from political parties that couldn't exist under this formerly military repressive situation.
Wow. And you got to witness some of this. What did you learn by observing these free and fair elections in countries in Central America?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I think I came away with in terms of observing elections was the opportunity for a spectrum of political, you know, that there wasn't a two-party system. So that was new for me, that there were parties that represented the hard left or the far right, and coalition, you know, Christian Democrats in the middle. That was literally the name of a political party, Christian Democrats. And so there was this plurality of parties, and those parties working in coalition to be more representative of a bigger body of people, right? Because you had people on the far right and far left that supported both of those, but there was just this plurality. And one of the things that I remember is that the ballots for voting were all color coded so that if you didn't know, if you couldn't read, you knew the colors of the party you were supporting. So if it was, you know, green and yellow, or it was blue and orange, or it was, you know, like that was new. And like, of course, you know, my experience of voting was I'm a literate, educated person, yeah. But if I'm not, the idea that you would make an electoral ballot accessible to me because I can identify with a symbol, a color that I know is connected to the party that represents my point of view.
Yeah, like they actually wanted people to be able to participate regardless of literacy, status, economic status, all that stuff. They actually wanted people to vote.
Yes. Yes. And I remember being in, you know, some rural community and people lined up before the polls are open, lined up to participate in voting. It was exciting to watch people vote for the first time in what they considered free and fair elections. And that was true a couple times that I was able to be in Nicaragua for elections. And then, you know, years later, I was living in El Salvador in 1994 after the negotiated settlement of that civil war, which the settlement was in 92. So elections were in 94. And then I was living there watching, being trained to be an observer and training delegations to know what to look for. And so that was, those are, you know, different countries and different time periods, but just having those experiences helps me appreciate, you know, where we are in this country. And, you know, once upon a time, I think that parties did represent a plurality of perspectives, or there was a platform. You know, when I was young, I can remember learning about the platform of the Democratic Party, or the platform, what issues they were, you know, but that's not what we have now. And now we know that, you know, our Constitution was designed to keep women, persons of color, indigenous people, they didn't have the opportunity to vote. So now we need to work for the equal access to power of the vote for everybody. Mm-hmm. Because people who've been historically excluded from that process, there's generations of people that, you know, came and went in this country that didn't have the opportunity to vote in a democratic society.
Right? I know it.
Yeah, I know, you know.
What else would you say to like current US citizens? I mean, we've just been through this election. There's been a lot of talk about, was it free? Was it fair? What have you now observed, now being back in the US for as long as you have, but having all of this international experience with elections, about how our democracy actually works here in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, it's a flawed system. Its origin was designed to exclude women, persons of color, indigenous communities. And so now we have to identify ways that all of those people have access to the vote. And I do believe that for the most part, I think the courts, this year's election, you know, this last November was like no other. We've never had as many people vote in this country, which is exciting and pathetic historically, mm-hmm. that we have elected president after president with less than 50% of the population voting. But that's because there's a history of people being marginalized and excluded from and believing that their vote doesn't count or that they can't make a difference. And that it's really the educated who might vote, but you know what I mean? Like, so we have to change the culture in our country so that the narrative for women, persons of color, indigenous communities, that we're electing people who represent those people. Because if we elect people who represent those people, things are going to change. And of course, that's a threat if you're on the far right or the far left, right? Mm-hmm. That although hopefully people on the left are trying to be more inclusive of people in the middle and the persons of color, the women, the indigenous, that's part of what the left would say they're trying to protect and encourage. But yeah, this, you know, what we saw a month ago, what we're hearing about, you know, in this week in the news in terms of the impeachment, I do believe we had a free and fair election. And I do believe that because of people organizing in places like Georgia, I mean, the Georgia story is one that needs to be told.
Mm-hmm.
You had Stacey Abrams, whose election to be the governor was clearly flawed and fraudulent.
Yep.
And she went on to organize people enough to elect two senators, that a Black man and a Jewish man.
You know? From Georgia.
It's just an unbelievable story, but therein lies the power of women, persons of color, working for their own, in their own interest, in the best interest, in the common good interest. That it's not, and you know, I don't, you know, we don't need just the idea that white men in this country continue to be elected and then they're not reflecting who they're elected to represent.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we have this stalemate in, you know, currently with the idea that Donald Trump may not be convicted of his crime.
Oh yeah.
Because there's a bunch of white men who are more identified with a party than with a process, mm-hmm. than with representing the poor, the marginalized, all the people who suffered in the last 4 years. And that's a lot of people, a lot of people. So I know I'm kind of getting off here, but
no, it's bad. I know it's bad. I don't want to leave Central America before we really talk about the Catholic connection,
mm-hmm.
because of course in the late 70s, early 80s, many Catholic leaders in Central America were murdered under just brutal, gruesome circumstances. And now I know that you've continued to be involved with honoring those martyrs, mm-hmm. whether it's the church women, whether it's the martyrs of El Salvador, Oscar Romero, all these Catholic leaders, mm-hmm. who were convinced that the message of the gospel was not living in oppression.
Yeah.
And tell us about your connection with the murder of the Catholic leaders and sort of how that has evolved now over the last 40 years.
40 years, yeah. Yeah, I was in the JVC office in March of 1980 when my Jesuit colleague called me and said, "Kate, they've killed the Archbishop in El Salvador." And again, I didn't know what that meant, but that moment is a moment that I can point to where my life took a different turn. murdering the Archbishop in El Salvador, and 9 months later, the murder of the four church women, two Mary Knoll sisters, Ursuline sister, Dorothy Kazel, and Jean Donovan, layperson. Dorothy and Jean were part of the Catholic mission team from the Diocese of Cleveland, and Maura Clark and Ida Ford were Mary Knoll sisters who had been living and working in Central America for a long time. And so I was in Cleveland in March of 80 when Romero was killed, and I was in Detroit in the fall of December of 1980 when the church women were killed, and very connected to the church women's murder really brought the reality of what was happening to the four churched people here in this country, that they were North Americans, that they were missionaries, that they were women doing basically Christian service work, transporting refugees, feeding the hungry, sheltering kids who lost their parents. I mean, they were just doing some really basic care of people in the midst of great danger, actually. I mean, they knew that their lives were being threatened by close to the end of their days. They knew that. And they elected to stay and be with people who were suffering. And I think, you know, that's part of who we're called to be. Not necessarily martyrs for our faith, but faithful to what gospel values ask us to do. And that is creating community, providing shelter, hospitality, welcome, just being present with people. Mm-hmm. And that's who we are, I believe, as people of faith. And again, for me, staying close to people who would help me do that has meant years of staying connected to the Salvadoran community, the faith community in this country that continues to be a part of, from, you know, the Underground Railroad in the early 80s, moving people who were coming into this country as refugees and seeking asylum that they couldn't get here in this country because of our government couldn't acknowledge that we're creating this refugee system and offer asylum. So the Underground Railroad brought people through the US, through Detroit, into Canada. And I was part of that. And sometimes at risk, I don't feel like I was ever at risk. I mean, people I was transporting were way more at risk than I was, but yes, the lives of Romero, the church women, and in between the Jesuits who in El Salvador killed for, again, their work with the poor, their drawing attention to what was happening there at the time. Again, witnesses to faith that calls us to be sisters and brothers to people who need support, who need community, who are asking us to know the truth, tell the truth, and sometimes risk the consequences of telling the truth. But yeah, I think when I look back on the spectrum of, you know, JVC, living and working in Central America, living and working here in this country with people who are committed to living faithful lives, there's been great adventure in all of that. I think the gospel is adventurous. I think being in community is hard work and adventurous, but it's worth it. It's helped me stay close to who I think I am, right? That my parents who modeled hospitality and care for the neighbor has it's just been like the next thing, you know, whether it's JVC or, you know, volunteering at Cristo Rey, like being a BART volunteer, BART chaperone, helping kids get to work. It's just part of who we're called to be. And at least I know that that's my call, that whether it's ensuring full participation in our civic life or advancing the voices of women in our church, that those are gospel values that are highly charged, motivating for me. And, you know, as a out lesbian, the magisterium, the high church doesn't care if I'm sitting in the pews. I want to be back in the pews and singing in the choir. But more importantly, I want to be a part of a community that's going to help me be who I am, be who I'm called to be, and keep helping us move forward with creating a more inclusive church, a more inclusive civil society that's looking out for women, persons of color, indigenous, and that those need to be our, all those groups need to be our partners in mission, if you will, and help us, you know, as we say in Ignatian circles, go where we're needed, respond to a call, and be available for mission. Mm-hmm. What is it that we're being asked to do? Who's calling us and how will we respond? And not individually for me. This is not I'm going to do this, this, and this. I'm going to do this because you're inviting me to, and you're a part of my people, and you're going to help me make it about the mission, the project, the community, not me.
Yeah. Hallelujah. That's the perfect place for us to end, Kate.
Thanks, Marlene.
I like how you brought it back around to your dad and your parents teaching you about community. And I guess the larger message to parents is be careful what we teach our kids, right? Because exactly. If you teach them about community and you teach them about being hospitable, they just might do it.
Yeah, they just might. They just might.
And they just might do it forever.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for sharing so much of your cool story.
Thanks, Marlene. It's an honor and a privilege to chat with you.
Thanks for listening to On a Mission. Get all of the details about this episode, including links to Jesuit Volunteer Corps, Witness for Peace, the Jesuit Office for Justice and Ecology. Find all that good stuff at MarleneDupreeDominguez.com. While you're there, make sure you sign up for my weekly email newsletter, which contains prayer tools, cool stuff to read, and links to other progressive, faith-based stuff around the internet. Also, try and review this podcast wherever you listen. I've expanded the reach of the podcast now to more than 5 channels. Let's share these inspiring stories with more people. Follow me on Instagram and Twitter @_Marlene. Thanks for all your support of the podcast. See you next time.